Ein neuer Tag auf der Liebesinsel. Es wird gezwitschert, geflirtet.
Bist du einfach reich?
Bin reich mit Liebe.
Gestritten.
Viel Spaß mit der Hexe hier im Haus.
Und gefeiert.
Die Party kann losgehen.
Love Island VIP ist back. Endlich. Donnerstag, 20.15 Uhr bei RTL 2. Und auf RTL Plus streamen.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck sticks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going out there? It's so fucking hot here. So fucking hot. I'm not complaining. I'm just telling you. I'm stating a fact. It's fucking hot. I'm one of these people, though. I don't really mind the heat. I don't mind it. I prefer it dry. I'll take it dry as opposed to mushy. And wet and sticky, I'll take it dry. It's about 100, 101, something like that. But I don't know, man. There's something about this type of heat that it's so intense that it relaxes me. I think that's another word for dehydrated. I feel woozy. I feel like I'm just sludging along. But I guess what it is that it makes me feel kind of buzzed. It's nice sometimes to, when you're sober, like I am, to kind of feel like you're almost going to pass out for a few minutes. That's what you're looking for. That nice little sweet spot of not quite passed out. And you spend a little time on the porch or taking a walk or you even just going down the street in heat like this. It's like, whoa, man, I'm about to go down. That ain't bad. It's too hot. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. So today, on the show, I talked to Spike Lee. Look, he's done a lot of big, amazing movies. Do the Right Thing, Bamboozled, Malcolm X, Jungle Fever, She's Gotta Have It. I'm just naming them off the top of my head right now. Spike has made a lot of movies. And his latest movie with Denzel Washington is Highest to Lowest. And it's going to be on Apple TV Plus starting tomorrow. 25th Hour was another one. That was a good one. It's a lot of movies. Crooklyn is actually one of my favorite Spike Lee movies. But Spike will be here. He's on this show today. Couple of things, big things to announce today. I told you about the new book we're working on with writer and illustrator Box Brown. It's called WTF is a Podcast, a graphic novel history of the show published by Z2. Starting today, you can pre-order for the book on Kickstarter. The book is already funded, but we're using Kickstarter so you can get more than just the book. You can order just the book or limited edition versions of the book, but there are also tiers for you to get signed merchandise from me and Box Brown, or get yourself drawn into the book, or get a signed wind guard from my microphone, huh? And one person can get their own episode of WTF. We'll record a private episode with you and edit it like every other WTF episode, and you'll have something that no one else has. Go to z2comics.com/WTF. That's Z and the number 2, comics.com/WTF. Also, the documentary about me, Are We Good?, will be in theaters Friday, October 3rd. In New York and Los Angeles, with nationwide screening Sunday, October 5th, and Wednesday, October 8th. Get tickets now at arewegoodmarin.com, and you can watch the trailer on Rolling Stone's website. What do you think of that, huh? And also, I'll be at Largo with the band next Wednesday, September 10th. You can go to wtfpod.com/tour. For tickets. Sorry, that was a lot of business. A lot of business. I think my Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is going to be on. I don't know when. Maybe tonight. I should know, but I don't. I just remembered that. But it's me and Sarah Silverman, and I guess I can't tell you anything else. I can't tell you anything else. But no, I can't say anything. Look, you guys, I'm becoming an older fella. And, well, this is kind of twofold, I guess, what I've gone through, what I've put myself through over the last few weeks. It seems to me that when I have a lot of good things going on and that my life from all appearances is pretty good, I will find something to focus on that will make it bad for me. That I can acknowledge all the good things, and I would say 45% of me is like, feeling pretty grounded in that. But then there's about 55% that's sort of like, I don't know, man, something's fucked up. And the last few weeks, it's been I decided I had cancer. And it wasn't based on much. I don't want to go into specifics because I don't want to open the floodgates to people emailing me about what I should have done, what it might be. Like, I don't want them to disregard the story and get specific with me and share their stories about something like mine, and yet they still had cancer. So I want to enforce some denial here that I can maintain by holding back a little bit of information. But I thought I had cancer. I was pretty focused on this one thing, and I kind of rolled it around in my mind for a bit and hyper-focused on it, and then decided, well, I'll go to the doc. And I go to the doctor. I go to the doctor I usually go to, the same practice, but I saw a different doctor. And this guy, look, seemed a little young to me. That's already an old guy thing, but I was like, I don't know this guy. Where's my guy? Okay, I got to get in there. I got to get in there today because I'm spiraling. I'm sure I'm dying. He checks me out pretty thoroughly for the thing. And he says, I'm not concerned about this. I'm like, okay, does that mean I'm good? He goes, well, I'm not concerned. Well, what does that mean? Well, come back in 3 months. We'll check it out then. I'm like, so, but it looks all right, right? I'm not concerned about it. Like, I think this might be kind of an issue with modern medicine. Well, I don't know, with medicine in general. Maybe it's not. Maybe there are specific types of doctors that can only say, I'm 90%, I'm pretty damn sure, I'm very confident, I'm not concerned, as opposed to no. Because I guess there's a barrage of tests that one needs to go through if you want to make doubly sure. So they're basically saying, like, I don't think you need the tests. And God knows, I would make money if you got the test, so maybe you should believe me. Fine. So I get that done, but I'm still obsessing about it, and I wait about a week or so, and I'm looking at it, I think it's growing, I think it's, changing this, changing colors, changing shape, whatever. So I call another guy who I know, another doc, the correct kind of doc for this kind of thing, who I've seen before, and I go into him, and he gets it under the microscope, he thoroughly checks it out. I ask him questions. He goes, I think you're fine. I think you're fine. I'm like, fine. Okay, well, that's two. And then I go home for another 2 weeks, and I'm like, oh, fuck. It's like totally cancer. And then I go back to the original place to see my original doctor. And this is after I texted the second doctor a few times. Like, I'm not sure, dude. I'm looking at this thing. It doesn't look right. He's like, I've been doing this 20 years, and I am beyond extremely confident, which is better than I'm not concerned. Beyond extremely confident that it's not a problem, that's pretty good. That's about as good as you're going to get from a doctor without testing. But that didn't stop me. I went back to the first place. I saw the doc that I usually see. He looked at it. He said, look, I think it's fine. 90% sure. And, you can get further tests, but that's going to be intrusive and I believe unnecessary, but I'll do them. But I think you should just come back in 2 months and we'll see what happens. I'm like, 2 months? He's like, but it doesn't look like cancer, right? He goes, 2 months. 2 months is not long for this type of thing. And we'll just do that. And I was waiting to see that doctor. And this is the old guy part where I said, what was the name of that guy I came to saw here before? And he told me the guy's name. I'm like, how old is that guy? Like, how old do you think he is? And the guy says, probably his mid-30s. I'm like, so he's been doing it a while? He goes, I don't know. But it's such an old guy thing to be like, wait, I don't want to see the young doctor. Where's the guy I usually see? He's not old, but he's older than you. I don't want the kid. I don't want to see the kid. Send in the grown-up doctor. I was not proud of that. I was not proud that I thought that way. But I don't think it's that unusual. Now the big question is, can I sit with it for 2 months and not go see a fourth doctor? I don't know. Only time will tell. I guess, as Kit pointed out, there is something about me going into these spirals, whatever they're about, whether they're about cats or something that needs to be done in the house and there's an urgency to it, Like when I freak out, I'm like, we got to get this done now, whatever it is. Even if it's not medical, even if it's just, you know, I panic about trees in my yard, it doesn't matter. But whatever it is, there's an urgency attached to it that is bad. And it makes me think that maybe the medicine I'm on is working, maybe it's not. And maybe I just have these neural pathways in my head that just drive me this way. And the thing was, even after the third doctor, you know, kind of confirming what the other two said, that they didn't believe it was something to be concerned about, there was a bit of disappointment. It's almost like, you know, just let's do a fucking biopsy or whatever needs to be done. And then when that's confirmed, then I can just sit there and wonder why I've got this hole in my body. And what did I do? That was stupid. Like there's, my brain is just wired to be panicky, to look for the worst, and then when the worst doesn't happen, to question that, and then maybe to take more steps that make it worse in a different way, so I never get out of that. And I don't know why I'm sharing this with you. Maybe it's helpful. I don't know. But I just can't give myself a break, and I better learn to, because I'm going to have a bit of time here. And I like to enjoy that time. Is that possible? I got a buddy who's going through his own health issues. This is just a stage of life I'm entering. But isn't there a way? Should I just go out and buy some stuff? Give some more money to charity? That's about the best thing I could do to make me feel like I'm doing something. But I'm okay right now. All right. I think I should tell you that after talking to Jackson Galaxy, again, this is another example because I'm having this trouble with Charlie beating up Buster. I've had him separated for like 2.5 weeks because Jackson told me to do that. But I'm pestering Jackson. I'm like, I'm not optimistic about this. What do we do next? And Jackson Galaxy came to my house and hung out with me and the cats for like 2 hours and told me, like, look, I have not seen a cat like Charlie. I have not seen a cat Charlie's age that is this fucking nuts. And I'm like, okay, of course, I get that cat. Or of course, I made that cat. I don't know what. And I'm like, what do we do? And then he's like, lays out this whole regimen where I've got to play with him like 3 times a day in intervals so I can peter him out. I've got to reward him after the play. Maybe I add a feeding before bed. So that kind of lights up. I've got to figure out a pattern of doing this. So he's distracted enough with the pattern I've created that maybe he'll lay off Buster. Meanwhile, Buster's on Buspirin, which is the same thing I'm on. And I don't know. I hope it works for both of us. I think it's working for me sometimes. I don't know if it's working for Buster. Apparently, it's going to give him confidence and make him super cat. But the diagnosis is that if Buster's going to act like prey, then Charlie's going to treat him that way. So that's now that I'm off the cancer, now I can fully focus back on, you know, the tension in my house. I don't know, man. I got to make some choices here because I'm going to have some time. Some time. Gonna try to focus on, you know, making a movie, but whatever. So look, Spike Lee is here, and his new movie, Highest to Lowest, premieres on Apple TV Plus tomorrow, September 5th. It's based on an Akira Kurosawa movie, which I watched, which is also great. He's obviously done all the movies. He's one of America's great film directors. I was happy he came by. This is me talking to Spike Lee. Yeah, this is exciting for me. How do you feel about Los Angeles when you come here generally?
Weather's nice.
That's it. That's the end of it?
I have a lot of friends here. I was just messing with you.
Yeah? You do all right out here?
Yeah. Get a lot of love in L.A.
Yeah, I went to the screening last night. And it was very...
At the Academy
thing? Yeah, very moving speech you gave at the beginning.
I said, let's go. why talk? We're getting ready to see the movie. Just let's go.
That's right. Have you talked about it?
Oh, I've been doing a lot. You know,
a lot of press.
A lot of press.
Do you set it up generally? Do you go up there?
No, interviews, not necessarily.
Yeah, sure.
Speaking before screeners.
Yeah, because I went. I kind of jumped back in. I don't think I'd watched a Kurosawa movie in a long time.
No, you've been missing out.
Well, I've seen them, you know, when I was younger, right. Studying
so
this stuff.
You have not revisited them, huh?
Yeah, well, I haven't seen this one, and it's a later one, right?
1963.
Yeah. And when you're doing a movie like this, what's the kernel of it? You know, why out of everything you know and have seen, do you decide to do that?
Well, thank you. You know, I don't think we've met before. Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
Denzel, does this script was going around for a lot of years, many different writers, many producers, stuff like that, and ended up in Denzel's hands. And
really?
And he called me up and said, I'm sending you the script.
Yeah.
And let me know if you want to do it. So when I hung up with the phone, I knew I was doing it already.
Yeah, because of Denzel. Yeah.
You know, his magnificence.
Yeah.
And also the relationship we've had with the four films.
Yeah.
Mo Better Blues.
Yeah.
He Got Game. No, excuse me. Mortal Blues. Malcolm X. He got Game.
Yeah.
And I even know that Inside Man, the last one we did together was 18, 19 years ago. I didn't even know that.
Is that crazy?
Time waits for no one.
That's for sure. I usually notice, like, I don't feel like time flies by, but I do know all of a sudden you're old.
For me, sir, it's flying by.
Is it?
Flying by.
But was did you have a love for Kurosawa to begin with?
Oh yes, I went to NYU graduate school, and Ang Lee was my classmate, the great top Ernest Dickerson.
Yeah,
Jim Jarmusch was ahead of us for 2 years.
Yeah,
so it was at NYU graduate film school, and I got introduced to world cinema.
Yeah,
and the basis of my first one, She's a Habit, comes from Rashomon.
Right,
so I got to meet the great Kurosawa, Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah,
so. He's one of the greatest directors ever. So it did not take me a millisecond, you know, to say this is something Denzel and I should do. But here's our approach. We took the approach of great jazz musicians who take an American standard.
Sure.
You know, we were Coltrane and not necessarily, you know, Julie. No disrespect to Miss Julie Andrews.
Sure.
Or Roger Hammerstein. But, you know, we you know what Miles did with My Funny Valentine? We go on. Great jazz musicians who flipped standards. And that was our approach. We were jazz musicians in front and behind the camera.
So that was the thought that, you know, here's a story.
That way is not going to be a remake. It's going to be a reinterpretation.
Right.
Yes.
But there's the story solid. So, you know, you got the...
Yeah, but the story, the story was by Ed McBain.
Yeah.
Who wrote it first? Then Kurosawa adapted it.
Okay,
it was called King's Ransom. Ed McBain.
Was it a movie or a novel?
It was a novel. What Kurosawa adapted.
What was interesting in that, you know, you and Denzel,
dynamic duo.
Yes, that you know you're of an age, right? So
you saying we're old?
No, I'm not. I'm just a little younger. I'm just a little younger.
But, look, I'm just messing with you.
No, it's okay.
It's all good.
But in terms of seeing yourself in a film emotionally, it seems like this one, in the way you guys interpreted it, was close.
I'm not going to refute that, sir.
And in terms of taking in,
I was born 1957.
I was born 63.
Yeah.
But the idea of the integrity of the elder's taste.
Are you talking about the generational rift, sir?
I was trying to put it diplomatically.
Well, you were very diplomatic. But it still hurts.
Hey, look, I'm in the same boat. Because, you know, in the Kurosawa movie, this is a guy who runs a shoe factory.
Right.
And for it to be placed in the world of music and then to have an intergenerational thing and then also deal with the sort of class issue within the friendship of him and Jeffrey Wright's character.
The great Jeffrey Wright.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
But I just saw the sort of moral weight. And there was a couple moments in the movie that to me like struck me in such a way that – and they were passing moments. Like when he touches his kid's ear.
Mm-hmm. In the car.
Yeah. Oh, he's mad. He's mad. You know, and then in the office later with his partner, basically saying, no one's got your back in this business. Mm-hmm. They seem to be the sort of like, those are the two sides of the heart challenge.
Yes.
And they're just in passing moments. Now, when you when you have moments like that, do you feel the weight of them?
I think it's accumulation of those moments during the course of the film.
Yeah.
And for me, this film is the weight of the film is about morals.
Yeah.
Morals of what you will. Denzel is such an exquisite actor. The audience put themselves what he's going through.
Yeah.
And then that means that they're buying into the film.
Yeah.
Which you want as a director.
Yeah.
And amazing thing, they ask themselves, what would they do in their own lives for what's happening on the screen in front of them?
That's right.
The great Denzel Washington.
Yeah. And the moment where, because in an arc like this, you know, that character's got to change. Mm-hmm. And in that third act, it's like, this is the change, and this is who this guy is, and this was inside of him.
Deep down inside.
That's right. And
but he's been worn down, though.
Yeah.
You know, this any business can beat you down, especially with the music industry today, where it is where they're the labels are dropping people on the on the staff, and they're dropping groups.
Offices are empty.
Yes,
all over New York and any business.
Yes,
it's kind of crazy, man.
Bananas.
Yeah, I mean, I went to Hearst to do some press for a special. I got up and I was like, "Where's everybody?" Just empty computers.
But here's the thing, though. Yeah. A lot has to do with the COVID, where
sure, yeah, you gotta get people off the screens and back in.
Yeah, but they, this. I'm sorry, if I was running a business, your ass is gonna be. This only come in 3 days a week. Hell no,
no, no. I think some people are going back.
Yeah, but the boss has got to tell people to come back because, you know, you can only fake it so much when you sit in your desk, but when you go home, We don't know what they're doing.
No, yeah. It's not a real conversation if one person could be sitting there going, I'm not wearing pants.
Or less.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. If the camera's not on. But, like, in terms of how the thing opened, I noticed that in the original movie, and I think throughout most of your work, that, you know, let me shut this air off. One of the primary, I run a professional operation.
A one-man show.
That's it. One of the primary characters is New York City, right?
Yes, sir.
And, you know, the way you shot it in this thing is different.
Different how?
Well, it's a different city. And, you know, the locale is different. The what it implies about the characters and the distance between him and Brooklyn and the...
But he lives in Brooklyn. That building's
right,
in Brooklyn.
Right over the river.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, and those buildings weren't there. This is a new New York, right?
A new Brooklyn.
Yeah. And in terms of your relationship with that, because the arc of it from the beginning of movies and then through, the 25th hour, mm-hmm. which was, the New York at its lowest emotionally.
Yes.
And in Do the Right Thing, it was probably New York at its most chaotic. Mm-hmm. And now you have this strange new stability that's a little sterile, no?
No, it's not sterile. There are many different. First of all, it's not even a borough. It's the neighborhoods.
Yeah,
it's the neighborhoods that make up the boroughs, and the boroughs make up the city.
Yeah.
So there's the waterfront. Brooklyn has been brought up. You know, Dumbo is huge now. So, and then the symbolism. I wanted to show right away without a whole dialogue about it. You see this drone shot that goes up to him on the terrace.
Yeah.
And right away, you know he has money. You go in his house, you see the artwork. And so
that's big money.
Big money. I mean, Basquiat, and you know they have money.
Michael Ray Charles.
Yes, Michael Ray Charles. Cayenne. So it's
This is
Abaddon. So they got money.
Yeah, serious money. Mm-hmm. And that all establishes that.
Right away.
The height, the art, the way he's on the deck. Important phone call.
From my brother, from the giddy up.
Yeah.
From the jump.
Yeah.
Right away.
Yeah. So that does everything in 30 seconds.
Yes. That's all you need.
Yeah. And you know there's a problem.
Well, you know it's coming. You know it's coming down the pike.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this can't be too good.
Yeah. But how do you feel about, like, you know, when in the scenes where... And I like this. There's something you do sometimes where, you know, a future is pictured but is not happening. Mm-hmm. You know, like you did with the music video in this one, yeah. right? And in the 25th hour, you did it with the life that was not had.
Yes.
And it...
I had done that a couple of times, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting sort of device because it doesn't take you out of the reality of it, but it definitely, you know, digs deep into the character's head.
What could have been?
Yeah, exactly.
What could have been?
Yeah. I read something interesting today about the analogy between Edward Norton's character in 25th Hour, what could have been, and what could have been for New York. Hadn't actually.
Send that to me, please.
You haven't seen that?
No, you said
it's a Rolling Stone piece from a few years back.
No, send it to me, please.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing piece because it discusses that no one was willing to take the risk or had the sort of acute perception to capture New York in that moment. Mm-hmm. They were erasing towers out of movies.
Oh, that was horrible. But we weren't doing that stuff.
No. And I was there. I was on my roof in Queens that morning. Mm. It was the fucking worst.
Yeah.
But the trauma of it, you know, it kind of rippled out for, it's still there.
It's still there. That's, you're telling the truth.
Has your relationship with New York changed in any way? You just feel it's the same place?
New York is ever evolving.
Yeah.
And that's my home, you know. And New Yorkers go with the flow.
Yeah. But it is sort of the creative resource, right?
Well, not like it used to be, because before, Madonna, all these people
yeah.
came from other places, and they could find rent someplace.
Right.
You can't do that no more, not
That's
New
right.
York City.
That's right.
I mean, not the outer worlds, but rent is crazy.
Yeah. So it doesn't have that.
So it's not going to encourage young people can't afford. I'm going to make it absolute, but a lot of young people can't afford. You know, the David Burns is not, you know.
Can't live on the Lower East Side anymore.
Nah.
I lived on second between A and B in, 89.
Really?
Yeah, you're just sort of like, I don't need heroin. I appreciate it.
But you're right in the middle of it right there, though.
It was crazy, man.
But it was artful. I mean, a lot of artists were right there.
All down there.
Yeah.
Where'd you come up? When you were at NYU? Well, your dad was a musician.
Yeah, so, but I mean, I grew up, we were the first black family moving to Cobble Hill. Brooklyn was a stone Italian-American. Then my parents bought our brownstone in Fort Greene, Brooklyn for like $50,000.
Yeah.
Right across the street from Fort Greene Park. And I still, you know, that's my home. That's my home.
And do you still, like, because the art is such a powerful thing, it's an important piece. I don't think I've seen it sort of showcased as much in the movies of yours since Bamboozled, that you know seem to be almost based on a Michael Ray Charles painting, right?
Yeah, that was Michael Ray Charles got a lot of his work too when the getting was good.
Yeah, is it big now?
Oh, he's. You need to write several zeros to get by his work today.
But
and it's worth it too.
Oh yeah, it's great. Mm. But when you were a kid in the house of a musician, so your whole early life, the premium was put on creativity.
Yes, but here's the thing: my father, Billy, the great jazz bassist, folk bassist.
Yeah.
At one time, he was the go to guy, Bob Dylan. He's on the first Gordon Lightfoot album on the first Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
And then when Bob went electric, everybody went electric, and my father refused to play electric bass.
Yeah.
My mother had to go to work. We would starve because he was not playing electric bass.
Yeah.
He refused to.
And there wasn't enough stand-up bass gigs around?
Everybody went electric.
Yeah. Even the jazz guys? Yeah.
Yeah, but when Bob went electric, everybody went electric. And the people, you know, that who's making his money from.
Yeah.
My mother used to, every weekend, Lord and Taylor's and Bloomingdale's, she was living in there.
Yeah.
My father not quit, but refused to play jazz or bass. My mother had to start to work to support the family. You know, we all starved. All that stuff is in the
in
film
Crooklyn.
The
it's the best.
That autobiography.
I love that thing.
Thank you.
It's weird. The ones I talk about the most are Bamboozled and Crooklyn.
But to be honest, though,
yeah,
more strangers have come up to me on the streets all over the world yeah. and said Crooklyn's their favorite film.
It's beautiful.
More than Do the Right Thing, more than Malcolm X.
Now, in terms of that, like with Crooklyn, in terms of, was Dickerson on that?
No, Ernest, that was the first film that Ernest didn't shoot for me.
Yeah.
I mean, by then he got on directing himself.
Because the color palette on that thing is like 50% of the movie.
Yeah.
And the thought you put into that and the depth of thinking that goes into creating a color palette and shooting it, mm-hmm. there's an intention there, right?
Yes.
And in that movie, it was probably the intention of how bright you saw your childhood to be.
And also the Alice in Wonderland thing when the character Troy went down south and we had the anamorphic, you know, we used anamorphic lenses for that stuff shot down south. And
yeah.
People were banging on the projection booth.
Really?
It's out of focus, out of focus, out of focus.
Yeah.
People were bugging when we did that.
But that gave you the effect you wanted.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
And so when did your dad, did he eventually start pick up playing again?
He started doing my scores.
Yeah.
The score for She's Gonna Have It.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
School Days.
Right, right, right.
Great score for Do the Right Thing.
Oh, that's the best, right?
And Mo Better Blues, yeah, after Motor Blues. At the Mo Better Blues, the baton was passed to Terrence Blanchard.
And to work with your father in that way creatively, I can't even imagine how amazing that must have been.
It was love.
You know? Yeah.
He was very proud of me.
Yeah.
And he gave me what I needed for those films. But he also did the score for my films in my graduate films at NYU.
And what was it when you were in NYU? Because you got, what, four brothers and sisters?
Three brothers, one sister.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the oldest.
Yeah. What was it at NYU? I mean, it's just the gift of growing up in a household that encouraged creativity.
Yes.
I mean, that's irreplaceable.
Well, parents have a great influence on their children, good and bad.
Sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So not only did I get my love of music, my ears from my father, yeah. my love of sports came from my father, too.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's different today, but back then, I mean, whatever your father's team was, that was your team.
Sure.
Maybe not so today.
Yeah.
But back then.
Yeah. That, no choice.
No choice. And if the kid didn't like the father's team, the father wasn't around or divorced or something like that.
It was done out of spite.
Now it's crazy. I see young kids with their fathers. I know they're New Yorkers and Sid got a Red Sox hat on. I mean, Daddy, what are you doing? Where you been?
Where'd you drop the ball? Yeah. But also, like, you know, by example, you know, you learn from your parents what to do, what not to do.
You got the other side, too.
Yeah.
It's not just one-sided.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you're sort of like seeing that up close and seeing the world of musicians. That's a cautionary tale.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I won't be telling that tale.
That didn't make it in.
Yes, my father at the later years had some, you know, drug issues.
Yeah, so, sure. And that was just part of it, you know?
Jazz musicians back then.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about it where...
And it wasn't just jazz musicians. Musicians in general.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then the streets took it up, yeah. You know? But it isn't. I've had the conversation where you, like, not Coltrane, Bird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would have you gotten there without it?
Yeah. Well, they came, I mean, even with rock, you know, this thing where, like, drugs make you play better, open you up, and so on.
You got to know how to play first.
That's what they didn't tell them.
That's the trick.
They just thought they do some
dope, and that's
dope, and then they're going to be a great musician, but it don't work like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It don't work like that.
Yeah, that's the difference between a junkie and a pro.
Sad but true, you know. So, no, it's just everybody's individuals, and they go their own ways and routes for who knows what. And not all the time they end up good.
That's right. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, that's in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's a scene there in the studio where that was a great scene.
Thank you. And let me tell you this, my brother. The scene is great because we didn't do what was written.
Oh, you let him go?
No, I didn't know Denzel was going to start singing bars from Nas, Illmatic, and Rock didn't know either.
Yeah.
And so when you have great, great musicians or great actors, directors, whoever you call, what you want to call them, they allow, you know, I'm not going to tell Denzel you can't improv here.
Yeah.
I give an example, and he got Game. That Game can follow the son, Denzel and Ray Allen, in the script. Ray Allen as Jesus in the film is composed with 11 Zip. And Denzel played JV for Fordham, and PJ Carisma was his coach.
Yeah.
So in his mind, he never, Denzel never said to me, but in his mind, he was not going to lose 11-0. And he started throwing up some lucky shots. And Ray Allen was looking at me like, Spike, this is not what the script is going for. And instead of calling, you know, cut, he's giving me the technical sign saying, time out. It was crazy. But it made the film better. The film would not have been good if Ray Allen would have won 11-0.
Yeah.
And Denzel has the instincts.
He's a competitive dude.
But it's just, it made the movie better, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny. I once talked to Ethan Hawke about Training Day.
Right, right.
And he told,
King Kong.
Yeah, yeah. I never forget what he said. He said, you know, when he got that role, he was watching Denzel movies like teams watch the opposing team's game tapes. Because he didn't want to be handed his ass.
Here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Ethan was right, because if you come with that weak shit,
he's not going to.
It's not going to be nice. It's not. And so that's why.
You've seen that happen?
That's why what makes this film so great is the duel of High Noon between both of those guys in the recording studio.
And there was a moment there where you didn't know. Because of Denzel's character, before he shifts and finds his heart again, there's a point there where he might make the deal.
Coulda, woulda.
Right?
Right.
And you gotta play that tension.
Well, Denzel's a genius, and he knows how to do these things and just lift the whole film up.
Yeah. So when you were doing the early stuff, what was driving you in terms of influence? You know, from NYU. I mean, because you kind of got your own point of view.
It wasn't that quickly, but I will say this, though, is that going to NYU Graduate Film School, where I'm now a tenured professor of film and the artistic director.
How's that going?
I've been there 30 years. I love teaching.
Yeah.
I love teaching. And I wouldn't be there 30 years if I didn't love it.
Yeah. But in terms of the kids you're seeing, you know, and
they're grown. I mean, they're grown. Many
in their 20s,
later, many have left other professions, with doctors, lawyers, stuff like that,
and they want to learn.
They want to be a filmmaker.
But there is that moment, man, in this new movie where you know the new breed is laying down his pitch for what makes money, and you got to be up against that. With younger people coming into movies, you know, what's the easy way? What if I do a clip to sell?
I tell my students who I've been through, my experience, and I don't try to fake the funk or lie to them.
Yeah.
And the number one thing is you got to put the work in.
Yeah.
You can't, if you think you're cheating, the game, but you're cheating yourself.
Right.
So my thing is work ethic, work. And here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
That when you love what you do, it's not work.
Right.
So if you're not working, it's not what you love. Right?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
But you say it took time for you to find your vision. But when you're going into those first four movies, well, she's got to have it. That was black and white, right?
That was black and white.
Yeah. And then, you know, School Days.
No, it was black and white because Jim Jarmusch is Strange in Paradise is black and white.
You got to keep up.
Jarmusch was there while he was 2 years ahead of me.
Yeah. And you loved it?
The publicity, everything that Jim did with Strange in Paradise, I did with She's a Habit, because I knew it was successful. I knew that I'm going to have to start as an independent filmmaker.
Yeah.
And Jim, even today when I see Jim, he says, don't say it, Spike, don't say it, but he's my hero.
Yeah.
I mean, Marty was not there and I was there. Oliver Stone was not there at NYU, so my contemporary was Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah. And it's so funny because you are the opposite. You're the opposite of black and white. You did one black and white movie, and then from then on, it's like all color all the time.
Yep.
You didn't like black and white?
I've had black and white sequences in my film.
Sure.
And I love black and white films, but it's the story. For me, the story tells you what you should do with it.
Yeah.
So that's how I roll.
And outside of Jim Jarmusch, you know, what was informing your brain in terms of how you want to shoot?
My other NYU brother, Scorsese.
Yeah?
That's my guy.
Pace.
I mean, it's more than pace, just his whole, his world and how he sees things,
yeah.
How he shoots things, just the utmost. And here's another thing is that when you're young, you know, there are people you love, but you never think that you're going to get to become friends with them. So
yeah.
me and Mario Tite, De Niro, so these are giants.
Yeah.
I've become very good friends with Steven Spielberg over the years.
Yeah.
He came, I showed, sometimes I have guests in my class, and we showed Close Encounters. The lights went up, and then Spielberg walked in front of me, the front of the class. The class went fucking berserk. It was a surprise. I didn't tell him that Spielberg was going to be. And he was just gracious enough to spend time with the class.
It's a great movie, though, isn't it? Close Encounters?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can't get it out of your head.
Yeah.
And then the color, and he's got Truffaut there. I was reading into that because, you know, I remember studying, you know, film. I was reading into it. It's like Truffaut, sight and sound, basic shit. That's it.
Great movie.
Oh, yeah.
And he's made great films, will continue to make great films.
So I imagine that the early Scorsese stuff in how New York was.
Mean streets.
Yeah, how it was pictured. The sweat and the grit that had to, like...
A lot of that was determined by the budget, too. I mean, he didn't have a lot of money, to do what...
But he's not unlike you, he's intrinsically a New York guy.
New York guy.
Yeah.
New York.
Yeah. And
Y-A-W-K.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, like, in Giancarlo, like, his career, look at that.
Esposito?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Plug it out.
Yeah, but it's amazing.
He was at the screening the other night we had here in L.A., and it was just a joy for us to give each other a big hug.
Yeah. When you watch these movies from back in the day as who you are now, how do you...
You know what I say? Oh, we were young.
Do you? Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you just see how... I mean, when I see myself as Mookie and Do the Right Thing, I'm like, Mookie's kind of old right now.
But is it cringy or is it good?
It's good.
Yeah?
It's you think back to not only that film, but what you're doing at a time and what's happened in the world at that time.
Yeah.
And how these all of us talented people came together on this film and gone on to have great careers.
Are you self-critical?
What's done is done.
You give yourself a break? Yeah.
What's done is done.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta... I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing if I kept living in the past. You gotta on to the next one. On to the next one. On to the next one.
I noticed in this movie, no moving...
Yes, there are.
There are?
Two.
Oh, shit.
The double dolly shots there twice. Look, check it out again. You'll see.
Yeah.
It's even in the short film, music video.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I guess I was always waiting for the moving.
It was moving. maybe it wasn't. I think it was a little subtle for you, but it was moving.
But that's a music video. Like, I was waiting for the, you know.
But that's the thing is that that's in his mind is going to happen.
Sure. But what about that shot?
I didn't invent it.
But it's almost a signature thing, though.
It's become a signature thing over the years.
Yeah.
The best use of it, in my opinion, is in Malcolm X.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I did a lot of interviews, and more than one person said that they thought that Malcolm knew he was going to assassination. We went to speak at the Ottawa Ballroom that day.
Yeah.
And then you couple that with one of my favorite songs of all time, A Change Is Gonna Come by Sam Cooke. I mean, that's why that's my best use of the double dolly shot.
Was that one?
It's that one. Malcolm X.
Yeah, because it was foreshadowing, foreboding.
Yes, that's the word.
Haunted.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you first started, Malcolm X, that's another great example because that, you know, you had to direct that movie. And, you know, what I remember about it outside of Denzel's, you know, performance and the story of Malcolm X was how much attention you paid to Zoot Suits.
It was the era. And we want to make people understand this is the Zoot Suit.
Yeah, but it looked so, it was so visceral.
It was like a Hollywood musical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you knew that.
We wanted that. I mean, you see the different color palettes,
yeah.
You know, going with the great Ernest Dickerson and
yeah.
cinematography
yeah.
to take us through many, many different decades and the different phases of Malcolm X's life.
Yes. Because I know as a comic that Red Fox was there.
Well, he knew.
Yeah.
He's not in the film, but he knew.
Yeah, he knew him, right? He worked at a restaurant or something.
They knew each other.
Yeah. Yeah. But what's your history with comedy coming up as a kid? Because I know you did the Kings of Comedy. And I know you
comedy,
did
Comedy, Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
It's funny because I'm the first of five. And so we had to vote for the TV.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted Knicks games. And my siblings would vote for the Brady Bunch and what's the other
right.
one?
Right, yeah, yeah. Partridge Family?
Yeah, the Partridge Family. Yeah. I got voted. I was like, I wanted to watch the Knicks.
Yeah,
I'll get outvoted.
Yeah.
Even that's in the Crooklyn.
That's in there, yeah. Mm-hmm. When does the appreciation for painting start?
Mm. For art, I think I was able to have somebody to buy some.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. Because it's interesting in this movie where, you know, that it does have a status implication, but they are works of art.
A lot of that art is from my home.
Yeah.
So it's copies of it.
Yeah.
But I have Basquiat's and...
Yeah.
Not those ones, but...
Yeah.
A lot of the art is copies are made...
And of that
used,
stuff?
And used in the film. And again, it's a shortcut to show how fluent
yeah.
they have also their taste.
But it did. Does it impact your point of view in terms of creativity? I mean, like when you see a painter, you know, do that thing or a jazz musician do that thing?
No, it just shows that there's art on the walls,
yeah.
too. There's
yeah.
art on the walls.
Right, but for you as an artist... Are you able to appreciate painting in that way, or you just see it
oh,
as
yeah.
a painting?
I mean, paintings, photographs.
Yeah.
You know, I got several. I had one of my best pieces. I
yeah.
have a portrait of Malcolm X that Richard Avedon signed to me.
Oh, yeah?
Love that.
That's photograph.
Yeah, photograph.
Yeah.
Portrait.
Yeah. That's great.
I have a Basquiat that's... About Satchel Paige. He spelled Paige wrong.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Satchel's my daughter's first name.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's special.
Did you know Basquiat?
My brother knew him better. They went to art and design high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
I went to... The only time I met him, he came to the after party for the She's Gonna Have It premiere.
Yeah.
He came with Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of us all together.
Yeah.
With Fab Five Freddy.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Basquiat, it got away from him, too.
Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah, but he tapped into something.
Yes, he did, and he's going to live forever as long as his art is around.
And what about, how well did you get to know Melvin Van Peebles?
He's one of the giants as far as black filmmakers and
yeah.
what he did with Sweet, Sweet, Sweetback, so... And then I got to know him, and also we had a block party the day before we were going to shoot, start Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing was shot on one block.
That's almost like a set.
Yeah, and the block has
like been... Like a studio set.
The block has been renamed Do the Right Thing Way by New York City, the only film.
Yeah, don't let Trump take that away.
He might try if he finds out about it. So... He came to the kickoff party.
Yeah.
And he gave us a blessing. So I was very honored for that to happen. I mean, he showed what he didn't need the studio.
Yeah.
He did his thing, and against the system, against the studio, made a hit and a declaration, really, for black independent filmmaking.
Now, in terms of the kind of the confrontation and Do the Right Thing, and then, you know, in terms of dealing with race in, you know, Jungle Fever and all the movies, was something, you know, you could feel as a visceral confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, the reason I get hung up on Bamboozled, mm-hmm. you know, as a comic, and as I thought that, and I talk about it a lot, that the way you brought television production values mm-hmm. to minstrelsy
mm-hmm.
was some sort of, it was something I never thought I'd see and I can't unsee, but the elevation of it mm-hmm. delivered the message in a way that was so, you know, powerful but poetic that, you know, it seems to me that you put a lot of effort into making sure if anything in that movie was going to be right, it was going to be that fucking TV show.
Mad Tan's Minstrel Show. And I appreciate your statement about that. But for me,
yeah,
the film is about that last 2 minute montage of images of black famous,
yes,
Judy Garland. I mean, everybody
doing blackface,
doing, you know, blackface, yeah. History of that.
Yes,
and the cartoons, and that's what the film's about,
right?
And how. Well, what was the last words Brando said in Apocalypse Now?
The horror. Right.
The horror.
But when you guys were making that.
We knew what we were doing. And here's the thing, though. There are things in that film that are just painful. And I knew they were painful.
Yeah.
That's why it was hard to get the film made.
Yeah.
But as myself as an artist, I'm not just going to close my eyes and not acknowledge, you know, how this hateful stuff has gone out and definitely affected the world. So that was really the, you know, how we flipped it.
Yeah, but because of the production values, you're almost defying a certain part of the audience to like it.
Well, we didn't have a lot of money, so we shot that film on mini DVDs.
Yeah. That was the first one. It got a lot of press for being shot on digital.
Yes, and it was a budgetary.
But it was perfect for the TV show.
It worked for the TV show.
Yeah,
and Damon Wayans and
what he was. Damon. He was the best kind of worm. You know, like
I've been told he didn't like the film. You know, when it came out, but he just come over the years. He's come to appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Out there, he probably got a lot of flack. Like, why you do that film? Why you do that role? I never asked him about it, but I think that I know that film, you know, had made a statement about the industry.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I can't, like, it just blows me away. And
what's the name of the Mel Brooks?
Blazing Saddles?
No, the other one.
Who's
the one where it's a play and then it flips and...
Oh, the producers?
Yeah, that's where the premise of that really comes from. The producers where, you know, the intention is to make it a bomb and then it's the total opposite.
That's right. Oh, so that's where that came from?
Yeah. And that thinking that let's do something horrible and then on purpose it becomes a hit.
Yeah. What's the difference... You know, between like all the movies you do, like there's a different set of muscles when you're doing docs.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine a different intention that you can cover what you can cover in a movie, but you know some things are need to be handled journalistically.
Mm-hmm.
And what drives you to do the docs?
It's a different. Like I think it's a different muscle.
Yeah.
But for me, it's still on the heading of filmmaking.
Right.
So I never want to limit myself, you know, don't put handcuffs on myself.
But
my hands behind my back, you know, there's many ways to tell a story, many different ways to tell a story.
And how does something like, you know, Four Little Girls come together?
I was hoping you would ask that. Four Little Girls, I think, is some of my best filmmaking ever.
Yeah.
For those who don't know at home, Four Little Girls refers to the four beautiful young black girls who were murdered when sticks of dynamite were placed on the 16th Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, during the height of the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
So let me tell you the story. We wanted to be nominated for Best Feature Documentary.
Yeah.
And so in order to do that, you have to have a one week of theatrical run.
Yeah.
In New York is a film forum.
Yeah.
And so we're beginning to begin that 1 week run, and I get a call from the FBI. They want to see a print of the film.
Really?
Now, J. Edgar Hoover knew whose guys were.
He was still alive then?
Who?
J. Edgar Hoover?
No, I think he died, but yeah. It's just still the FBI still. Yeah. He was alive when the bomb went off. They knew within the week who it was. The guy's nickname was Dynamite Bob.
Yeah.
So before the film was about to open, I get a call from the FBI.
Yeah.
And they want to see a print.
Yeah.
I send them a print, and a couple of days later, they open up the case and indicted two of the other murderers that were still running around.
Huh. And was there any party that thought that they were just trying to get ahead of it?
They probably felt they didn't get the bomb went off. The bomb went off in 1963. I mean, when in.
But they knew you were going to bring it back to the attention.
Oh,
the film was.
The FBI or the murderers?
The FBI.
They knew about, they had to know about it because they wanted a print.
Yeah. That's what I mean. That they were, you know, we better resolve this. You know, synchronistically with the release.
Yes, with the release of the film. But yeah. They were, you know, Jacob Hoover is not a friend of Dr. King or the Civil Rights
Movement. Of course not.
So
yeah,
that's one of my proudest moments. That film sent some people back to jail, the prison after many, many years. They were around free.
Yeah, that is an amazing feat of successful social activism.
Yes. And I got to know the parents very well. A lot of them are no longer with us.
Yeah.
But the pain of knowing that young daughter is, I'll tell you another thing about this.
Yeah.
I have a great researcher. Her name is Judy Ailey.
Yeah.
And during the post-production, she found pictures of the girls. And I had a long discussion with myself, should these pictures, these grotesque pictures, be put in the film? And I put them in. I just felt that the world needed to see what these sticks of dynamite did to these beautiful young girls who could have grown up to be doctors, lawyers, just been allowed to live.
Yeah.
And were killed and nothing but hate. I had to think, because I'm thinking about what are the parents going to say when they see this, when they see their children blown up.
Yeah. They'd never seen those pictures?
Never. They must be hidden somewhere because Judy, she's great. She found them.
Yeah.
And so we got nominated for Best Feature-Length Documentary. I flew all the family out to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
We did not win, but the mother said that it was worth just coming out because they got a kiss from Denzel Washington. Because we went to he co-owned a restaurant at that time. And so we just went there after the Academy Award, and Denzel gave him a hug and a kiss on the cheek, and they were so happy.
And how did they feel about the movie?
Loved it.
Because even hearing you talk about the process of doing documentary, it is a form of filmmaking, but it is essentially journalism. It's a different responsibility.
Yes,
right?
And another big one was about that. Right now we're going with the 20th anniversary, you know, so my documentary I did about what's happening in New Orleans.
Yeah. When the levees broke.
Yeah.
And do you have the same that there's a deeper sense of satisfaction and engagement with unresolved things within the community.
Within the history of the United States.
Sure.
You know, yeah. And I found that I become very close. When I do documentaries, we stay friends. You know, it's not like I just, all right, we got the film, see you later. But I become very, very close friends with the parents of the four little girls who were murdered.
Yeah.
In September 1963, Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah. And the same with the Levy?
Yes. Oh,
got to know those people?
Well, I go to New Orleans, those are my people. So,
because it's interesting. It's not something there's a different experience in, you know, portraying, you know, Malcolm.
Yeah. I mean,
and the impact of that.
Yeah. There's a big difference. But here's the thing, though. What makes it the same for me is that it's storytelling.
Sure.
Whereas the storytelling.
Yeah.
And then both are storytelling to me.
And what about the four-parter? That must have been a mountain to climb, the New York City epicenters.
Oh, yeah. That dealt with 9/11 also.
Yeah.
Coupled with COVID.
Yeah.
And another one of the joints, I just look at like that, you know. And,
yeah.
Move on to the next, but the stuff I've done in the past still stands. So,
well, it's
keep it going.
But it must have been for you personally. There's a learning experience.
Yeah,
when I learn
every time I do something.
Yeah, but like when you're doing a script and you're making choices about, you know, how to shoot a scene, and then on the other hand, you're like, well, look at what I found about this.
Right.
Then that deepens your wisdom. Your understanding of things.
How you know that? I agree with you. Yes. And one, you know, and one impacts, I think, documentary filmmaking impacts my fictional stuff. It helps each other.
Yeah.
As for me, as a storyteller.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of it, though. You know, what was interesting about the newest movie is the attention to detail. Like, you know, you've got a plot point. They're going to drop this bag into the Puerto Rican Day Parade, and you're going to spend 5 minutes with the Puerto Ricans. We're going to get Anthony Ramos out there.
Rosie
Perez, yeah.
But also, who they introduced, the great Eddie Palmieri.
That's great.
Who just passed.
Oh, right? He did.
Passed away.
But see, that introduces that whole sort of like, this is New York.
Yes.
That and the train from the Yankees game.
They're going to Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, yeah,
and they're playing the Red Sox.
Yeah. But just that, and you got.
And the reason why I did that, I wanted to show that young felon is intelligent. He put this all together.
Yeah. Oh, no. I know. Like, that was a good mislead.
You know, he had to know it. It wasn't an accident. He knew that the Red Sox were Yankee Stadium or an accident that this was. This Sunday is a Portland Day Parade.
Yep. Yep. And then it's like, boom, back and forth. And who's that guy that, you know, that you use? I think you've used him before, but the, you know, the guy who's now on the insurance company commercials, you know, the tough guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
State Farm.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that guy's name?
Dean.
Yeah.
Dean.
He always delivers.
Yeah.
He delivers that guy.
Uh-huh. And we play with him, and, you know, being in the commercial too. So
you did,
you know, the word just mayhem.
Oh yeah, mayhem. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He got a pretty good
Dean
racket.
Dean Winter is his name.
He got a good racket going for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And when you finally won the Oscar for Black Klansman, was there a part of you that's sort of like, oh, fucking time?
The Oscar thing is, I mean. Here's the thing.
Yeah. Believe me, I've never won anything.
Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
Wasn't even nominated for an Oscar. And Drive Mrs. Daisy won.
Yeah.
Black Clans lost out to, what was the name of that film?
What, for the Best Picture?
Yeah, Best Picture.
I don't know.
Someone's being driven in that film, too.
Yeah, sure.
But I've not let that deter me from what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I understand that oxes don't necessarily mean that's the best thing. So
yeah.
just keep it moving. I mean, I'm mad for a day. You know, then just keep it moving.
Yeah.
On to the next. Keep it going.
How do you choose the movies if they aren't yours? I mean, like, when you get, like, well, Denzel brought you this script. What makes you want to do something?
Number one, chance to work with Denzel Washington. I mean, Inside Man was a long time ago.
Sure.
And in addition, that was it takes place in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, this is my home. So yeah. I knew what I had to do.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not any, I didn't have any, I knew I had to do.
Yeah.
To show the New York I love in this film.
Well, here's sort of a couple of outside questions. Is that, you know, when you shot David Byrne's show, that's a guy with a vision of his own.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the discussions and how did that happen when you did American Utopia?
We've become friends over the years. He just said, Spike, I want you to come to the show. And if you like it, you know, I want you to direct it.
Yeah.
And me and David are cool like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, like, I think that there is a sense somewhere in your brain that you understand a musical. And there's
From them genes, my father's genes. I mean, music is part of who I am.
Yeah, so.
My fiber. So, and I think that David has seen that through my films. So
yeah.
If he doesn't think I know music or can shoot music, he's not going to ask me to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, he came to me.
Yeah. Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've talked to him, too. He's an interesting guy.
Great guy.
Good. That band holds up, dude.
Yeah.
And also, like, the two comedy things, because I'm a comic. The original Kings of Comedy, which is great.
Thank you.
I remember I was at what year was that? I was at the Comedy Festival in Aspen, Colorado, probably in the mid-90s. And they had flown Bernie out there. And this is the middle of the snow, Bernie. And there's only white people in Aspen.
Right.
And it was one of the best things I ever fucking saw in my life.
Yeah,
because, you know, he's bringing a world just by nature of who he is. Mm-hmm. You know, and same with the dude who did, you know, BB's Kids.
Right.
Robin, right?
Robin Harris.
The best.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And you used him in which movie? Do the Right Thing in the second movie? Yeah.
Do the Right Thing.
Is that
Robin Harris' first film?
It's just that there's a raw world that has not been made, you know, in any way sort of like something that not white people can necessarily understand.
Mm-hmm.
And to see it in Aspen, Colorado.
They dug it, though, right?
Well, they when they got past the fear.
Had to get past that first, right?
Yeah, sometimes it's hard, you know.
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
But when you shot that, was that in DL at that time, too? Like, DL, young DL was fucking intense.
Mm-hmm.
Solid.
Right.
But was that
We shot two shows.
Yeah, that's all you need.
North Carolina.
Yeah.
And we it's become a classic.
Oh, yeah. And classic. What brought you around to, because I know you shot Gerard Carmichael when he was barely ready. How'd that happen?
He asked me. In fact, I didn't really know who he was when he asked me.
Really?
I saw a couple of shows. I said, come on, let's go.
And did you just knock it out in a day or two?
That was one night, two performances.
Yeah.
But the classic for me is Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy, you know, those things.
Dude. You know, to see that.
Did you know Richard?
I saw him towards the end. I was a doorman at the Comedy Store. I did not know him.
Uh-huh.
But I remember him.
Well, you've seen people come through there, though. I know you have.
Yeah, sure. But when I first got that job in the late 80s as a doorman, he started coming back around again. And he'd been out for a while.
Yeah, a little bit.
And the vulnerability of that guy was genuine. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I saw him go up on stage in the little room over there and not do well. And he couldn't, you know, hold the audience. And it was so painful and so amazing that to me, as a comic who's taking that in, that you're going to show up with that kind of vulnerability and take what comes is pretty heavy.
Yeah. Let me ask this. Comedians are crazy. Would you say that?
Some of them.
Cuppa included.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, to get up there on the stage,
yeah.
You're naked.
Yeah.
You're butt naked.
Yep.
And just...
Well, you know,
rough business, huh?
Well, you know, you learn how to, you know, you get a suit of armor that enables
the
you
to put that. The armor is the clothes,
sure, yeah,
to cover your naked body.
That's right. it becomes part of your personality. But like again, once you've been doing it, once the real fear goes away, mm-hmm. which I imagine you experience as an artist, mm-hmm. that you know, for so much of your career early on, you've got to pretend that you're not afraid.
Right.
And
repeat that, please, for our audience.
Pretend that you're not afraid and then, you know, live in that until the fear goes away. And that day, when that day comes, that's pretty freeing. Mm-hmm. But you feel it, right?
Yeah. So let me ask this question.
Yeah.
What happens, I'm not talking about you, yeah. but when a comedian bombs?
Yeah, well, you know...
from your experience. I know you never bombed in your life.
No. You do. Sure you do. I bombed a lot because I'm an angry fuck. So,
what are you angry about?
You know, just that I'm here.
Where you want to be.
Not sure. And that's a tough predicament.
Well, there's not a place you maybe, definitely don't want to be.
That's right. Well,
dead.
I think it's here. You know, that you're here.
All right.
But bombing... on some level, it took me a long time to learn it, is, you know, it's part of the job.
Mm.
You know, so if you watch Rock, you go up to workout shit.
Right.
He's not going to put any spin on it. He's not going to run around. He's not going to do the Rock thing, you know, where he's repeating and he's pacing. He'll just go up with the jokes that he wrote, present them with almost maybe at 25% personality. Just to see if the jokes work.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, it's not that it goes badly, but he knows that he's not going to kill. Right. And that takes courage. So the bombing thing, I think you get to a certain point where you're not going to totally eat shit, but you just start to know where the level is. Like, well, they're not coming with me for the
Say
whole.
Say that again, eat shit.
They're not going to totally eat Say- shit. But I'll tell you what you do feel, at least I do, is when it's not getting to where you, when you know you're not hitting, mm-hmm. and every joke is a different mountain, I get that. It's a little bit of sweat on the back of my neck. That's how my inner self knows that it's going down.
I've had that sweat on the back of my neck, and it wasn't about telling jokes either.
What was it about?
Well, we've all had some uncomfortable
yeah.
things in our life.
And, yeah.
It's not a good feeling.
No, but if you got your chops, you got to stay in the fucking saddle.
Yes, you're right.
And
you
hopefully
stay in there.
And hopefully the sweat doesn't start coming down your forehead.
Yeah, and can make you better.
Well, yeah, it'll get you tough.
Yeah,
you know it.
Tough business, though, comedians. All right, tough business.
Sure, it is, and I've been doing it most of my life.
How did it start?
To limited success at times. How to start?
Yeah.
Well, it's like anything else, you know.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in, my folks are from Jersey. I grew up in New Mexico.
Yeah, but what ex is New Jersey?
I know.
Anytime I saw something in New Jersey, I was my first.
What exit?
I was saying, what exit?
I got out.
Nothing about New Jersey.
I don't either. I got out too young. But I was driven because I felt that comedians, you know, for me, it was not. To be an entertainer, I felt like they had a handle on presenting truth
mm-hmm.
in a way that will make you see things differently.
Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor,
sure,
like that.
Well, just the idea that they could compartmentalize the most horrible things about life and the most frightening things about life into a package where you could sort of handle it,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that was a noble undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take on it. I saw some guy at the it was so funny. I saw Lil Ray Howery.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting next to me last night, and we got to talking about
at the screening.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Got to talking about The Road. Bill Bellamy, another guy I've known forever.
Uh-huh.
He was there.
Yeah.
Comics were there.
The comics were in the house.
They certainly were. Mm-hmm. So what's the plan now? You're going to run around and sell this movie?
Yeah, it opens tomorrow.
Yep.
And then September 5th goes Apple Plus.
And you got another deal with them to do another one?
Who?
Apple?
No.
No. That's just where it ended up?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got anything on the plate?
Yeah, stuff. I have stuff on the plate, but nothing I can really talk about in this moment of time and space.
Yeah, okay. Okay. But you're excited about it?
Oh, yes, yes. And anytime I get to work with my brother, Denzel Washington, you know, we're the dynamic duo.
Oh, yeah.
And we do our thing, so it's a blessing.
I can watch him do almost anything.
Brush his teeth. I mean, he's that
dude.
He's that dude.
Oh, man.
He's that dude.
I'll watch all those Equalizer movies. I'll fucking watch them.
He's that dude.
Yeah, yeah. Nice guy?
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very humble. But if you do something wrong, then you're gonna feel the heat. So you step out of line, you're going to say, I wish I didn't do that.
but it's quick, right? It doesn't last a long time.
Oh, no, you don't. It's like lightning quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's done.
And then it keeps stepping.
Well, I think Brolin tells a story about that, Josh Brolin.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Don't touch me. Yeah.
Nah, you don't want to mess with D.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that.
Well, I enjoyed the movie.
Well, thank you so much.
And I hope this conversation was enjoyable.
Oh, of course, of course. I mean...
And I saw somewhere you mentioned Facing the Crowd.
That's one of my favorite films.
How great is it?
I mean, my guy...
Yeah.
Bud Schulbach wrote that. Who wrote...
On the Waterfront. Waterfront. Yeah, yeah.
And so
yeah.
We wrote a script together.
Yeah.
So I'm still going to make... Because I promised to Bud we would make it on his deathbed. It's called Save With Joe Louis, about the relationship between the two heavyweights, Joe Louis and Max Schmeling.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and how's that coming?
It's going to happen. I made a promise to Bud on his deathbed. We came very, very close.
What is it about, like, say, because, like, Facing the Crowd, it's not an easy movie to find, generally.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about Billy Wilder and Kazan. They both won, went big with Sunset Boulevard and On the Waterfront. And the next two films bombed because of that time. America wasn't ready for those films.
Yeah, and The Apartment, too.
Yeah, but it's really a Face in the Crowd and the Wilder film.
Ace in the Hole.
Ace in the Hole!
The best.
But those films bombed. America was not ready for... those films that came after two Oscar winners.
Yeah. Well, Ace in the Hole is hard to find. Facing the Crowd is hard to find. And I think they tried to rename Ace in the Hole, you know, to...
They call it the Big Carnival.
The Big Carnival.
Yeah. A lot of times a film didn't work back in old Hollywood. They put it back out in the theaters with a different title thing. People know it's the same motherfucking film.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, they're trying to sell it. But the social satire, the cutting,
America was not ready for it at that time for those two films.
Facing the Crowd is like devastating. I gave it to a friend of mine who's become a big star as a cautionary tale. Mm-hmm. I suck it. Maybe you should watch this, buddy.
And you, I mean, people grew up watching maybe RFD, but they did not see.
No,
they did not see Andrew Griffin do that role.
Yeah, but what was it about those two guys in terms of their point of view that struck you so hard?
The cynicism.
Yeah. It's okay to do it.
And also, it's like morality, which is a big thing in our field.
Yes.
Kirk Douglas, he could get the story, but he's going to keep that guy buried.
That's right.
To keep it going.
Yeah, right.
And the guy ends up dying.
Right, right.
Andy Griffin, you know, he still CD cover.
Yeah, he keeps getting the money. Everybody goes away.
Yep, and he's going to run to be president. Then line him up for president of the United States.
That's right. Imagine that, a clown as president.
Yeah, and Patricia Neal.
Oh, my God.
She flipped the liver so this hate could go out all over.
Yeah, yeah, the best.
America, and then he got exposed.
Yeah.
But at that time, America was not dating. They won't,
So, yeah, but so it was just basically the courage to be cutting and to show the truth in a way that, like you're saying, they weren't ready for, but it was about as palatable as they could do at that time.
Yes.
They thought that they could do it.
Billy Wilder, Kazan, Bud wrote that script.
Bud won an Oscar for Underwater Front. Kazan won an Oscar Best Director.
Well, that thing probably moved.
And Billy Wilder, I mean, they won a ton of Oscars for Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. Also cutting. Also cynical.
Yeah.
And so The Big Knife, too. The Big Knife. You know that one with Rod Steiger, Jack Palance?
I got to check that out.
Dude, about the studio head, you know, and the actor. Like, you know, it's an Odette script,
ooh,
right?
And Clifford Odette?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But The Big Knife's about a studio head.
I got to check that out.
Who's got this guy on contract, Jack Palance, who come from...
Jack Palance?
Yeah. He comes from New York. He was part of like the People's Theater. He believed in the integrity of the art, and he sold his soul.
And then he woke up, right?
That's another one that goes right in that the America Wasn't Ready For It category.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, good to talk movies.
All right. Have me back.
There you go, Spike Lee. Again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Highest to Lowest is streaming on Apple TV Plus beginning tomorrow, September 5th. Hang out for a minute, folks. People, next week we have another guest we've been trying to get into the garage for a while. To many people, he's Luke Skywalker. To others, he's the Joker. To me, he's always the guy from The Big Red One with Lee Marvin. It's Mark Hamill.
You know, I imagine people talk to you about Star Wars a lot, but I'd like to focus the entire hour on Sam Fuller.
Oh, please do. Listen, I'll tell you something. Yeah. When they offered me that, The Big Red One.
Yeah.
I had an offer to go do Equus in San Francisco, and I was sort of thinking, why would I want to go? We were shooting in Israel.
Yeah.
Recreate the, you know, storming of Normandy Beach with all these young Turks that are around my age.
Yeah.
But I thought, I love Sam so much, I said, I should go at least go meet him, and not just turn it down outright.
Yeah.
So my point was, I was going to go meet him and explain to him why I didn't want to do it. He was such a dynamo, little guy.
Yeah.
But he got up and he started like acting out the movie. It was firsthand experience. He was just a teenager when he fought World War II.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this guy and he says, and then you get out there. Actually, it was Kollowitz, but I'm going to give it to you because you're so handsome. And he's acting out the movie and I'm mesmerized and I'm thinking, holy shit, I've just been drafted.
Yeah.
There's no way I can't work with this guy.
Yeah.
That's Monday's episode of WTF. And just a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here, I wanted to mellow out a pretty heavy song that we're actually going to be doing on September 10th, but we're going to do the heavy version. Thank you. rumor lives. Monkey and La Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.